that the U.S. policy, that the U.S. power is slipping in different parts of the world. I think we have to also take into account, though, that when that happens, the imperialists may become more aggressive, more adventuristic, and I think that's something we have to be very concerned about. We have to build a people's movement on the ground in solidarity with each other across the Americas and across the world to call for an end to U.S. aggression and belligerence and the threat of new wars, even more destructive wars.
Okay, Mike Billington, final question along the same lines of what I asked Richard Becker. When you have so much energy focused on a number of countries that are not U.S. friendly, to say the least, let's just imagine if Russia actually takes over Ukraine by some sense and takes over their production of grain. You could see that then you have food in that picture also. Then is that something that would prevent the U.S. from its hegemonic aspirations or its expansionist policies, as we see?
Well, again, the only way reversed is for people to recognize that the driving force behind the U.S.-British-NATO push for war against Russia and against China, not Ukraine, it's not Taiwan. Baker is right that they haven't for the people in Ukraine or the people in Taiwan. The purpose is that the Western financial system is breaking down, and they see that Russia and China have posed an alternative, and their reaction is destroy.
I'm sorry, I got to jump in, Mike Billington. We're just fresh out of time. I do apologize for that. Wish we had more time. Mike Billington from the Executive Intelligence Review, Richard Becker from the Answer Coalition. Thank you to you both. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Vitagui and the team, it's goodbye until next time.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
Ask the followers of the remembrance if ye know not.
You're listening to the program The Key on IRIB English Radio with Shiraz Hossein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program, The Key, here at IRIB English Radio. Thank you for joining us here today. Today on The Key, we're going to be examining a question which is kind of controversial and very sensitive because it's about one of the virtues of Imam Ali alayhi salam. And a lot of people, they don't want to negate and deny this the hadith which this question is surrounding, because they're kind of afraid that it might they might be contradicting and negating one of Imam Ali's virtues. Let's recite the hadith and the narration, and then we can talk about the question in the which is often mentioned in the context of the tradition that we will be reciting for you. Ibn Abbas, one of the famous companions of Imam Ali and the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam, he says that the sun was never turned back for anybody in history except Sulaiman, the Prophet Solomon alayhi salam, Yusha ibn Nun, also one of the prophets, the successor and heir of the Prophet Moses alayhi salam, and Ali ibn Abi Talib. This is a very general hadith regarding this event. But to be more specific, sometimes it's been mentioned by some of the narrators of hadith that the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam was in the home of Imam Ali, and he was resting his head on the thigh of Imam Ali. and sleeping. Some people say he was sleeping, or some people say that revelation came to the prophet at the time, and you know he went into a spiritual trance, and because of that, Imam Ali alayhi salam, out of his respect for the prophet, he didn't want to get up and disturb the prophet and awake him or disturb his spiritual state, and the time for the prayer elapsed, and because of that, the imam's prayer, it was missed by him, right? And then when the prophet came to out of his state of sleep or whatever, the prophet, the imam said, I missed my prayers. The prophet said, pray that the sun comes back and you can pray, right? And then the imam does this and the sun comes back and he prays. So a lot of people say, how could this be? How could we believe that the imam is infallible and he doesn't sin? So how could you say that the imam, he missed his prayers, right? On the other hand, some people say they don't want to contradict this because they say that if we deny this, we're denying one of the virtues of the imams, right? Right. So how do we resolve this conflict? This conflict and this problem and this question is easily resolved when we look at the reliable hadith and authentic hadith which has been narrated regarding this event in the Kitab Al-Irshad, which is a book by Sheikh Mufid, he narrates that this event occurred, the Prophet, revelation came to the Prophet, he put his head on Imam Ali's thigh, he went into this spiritual trance. Yes, it is true, the time for the prayer was very rapidly progressing, and there was not a lot of time left, but this hadith says that Imam Ali prayed by means of allusions, right? He prayed in a state of sitting down, and he completed his prayers. So there's nothing to indicate in the authentic narrations of this hadith that the imam missed his prayers. Thank you for joining us here on The Key. We were looking at the event of the returning of the sun and whether it alludes to the elapse of Imam Ali's prayers. Thank you. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Shiraz Hussein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy, on the program The Key on IRIB English Radio.
You can also send your questions to English Radio at irib.ir.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Puraza, London.
Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
The EU is Britain's largest trading partner by some distance, and the UK is the EU's third largest customer for goods. Therefore, there's a great deal to lose if relations continue to deteriorate.
This is illegal.
The 27-nation bloc is furious at plans by the British government to rip up the post-Brexit trade agreement relating to Northern Ireland agreed in 2020. Apparently, Boris Johnson's proposals would create a mountain of paperwork for businesses in Northern Ireland.
I mean, go and ask... I don't know the milk producers in Northern Ireland, how he or she can produce the milk, one sort for EU, another one for the UK, or any kind of manufacturer who wants to benefit from the access to both markets of the UK and the EU.
Brussels is taking London to court for not fulfilling the terms of the so-called Northern Ireland Protocol. The mechanism is designed to prevent border checks between the North and the Republic of Ireland, thereby avoiding the potential for sectarian violence. The United States is siding with the EU on this issue, which means London has limited options when it comes to finding new, big trading partners. Currently, just 15% of UK exports go to the US. And according to analysts, it would take years for London and Washington to agree on a new trade deal. EU leaders simply do not trust the British government any longer. Analysts have been surprised by the bloc's unity throughout the Brexit process after the EU spelled out its red lines.
And the EU has been very consistent in keeping to those red lines, probably more unified than anyone expected. Whereas on the other side, we have seen huge divisions.
This protocol presents for Northern Ireland.
It's been suggested, for political reasons, Johnson cannot back down now, and therefore it would ultimately require a change of government in London to avoid a trade war. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Grounded right before takeoff from a military airport in southwest England, as the legal wrangling over the fate of those due to be deported played out. The crew of the £500,000 taxpayer-funded flight to Rwanda soon realized they weren't going anywhere, as an 11th-hour intervention by the European Human Rights Council granted a reprieve to most of the 7 Middle Eastern asylum seekers on board, to the delight of critics of the government's immigration policy.
I was delighted. It really instilled my confidence in the judicial system, that people could actually pick out favourable politics and look behind that and identify potential breaches of human rights.
A defiant UK Prime Minister, though, says he's pushing on with his policy, and that he may now contemplate withdrawing from the European Convention on Human Rights.
What we want to do is to show the people traffickers that they're breaking the law, they're risking people's lives, and it won't work anyway. Now, will it be necessary to change some laws to help us as we go along? It may very well be.
At the moment, the UK's Interior Ministry forcibly removes anyone it deems inadmissible to claim asylum in the UK on a one-way charter flight to Rwanda, and houses them at facilities like this one in the capital, Kigali, a policy that has drawn fierce criticism from charities to the Church of England to rights activists.
Well, the government argument is they're doing this to put people traffickers out of business, but people such as yourself want the policy scrapped altogether. Why?
Immigration, asylum, and human rights are not at the top of the priority of this government's way of working with others, you know, less fortunate than themselves. We see the situation in Rwanda as being dressed up as something that it's absolutely not. I still have clients who are Rwandan refugees.
The UK has reportedly paid cash-strapped Rwanda $148 million up front for the deportation deal, and plans on making additional payments to the East African country based on the number of asylum seekers it deports.
The UK government says it's ready to do anything, including changing the law to make those deportation flights happen. But for now, a respite for desperate asylum seekers facing a terrifying future. Saeed Bourizza, London.
Senior U.S. Advisor for Energy Security Amos Hochstein met high-ranking Lebanese officials in Beirut. During the talks, Lebanese officials said conditions for talks are confidential, but stressed their main demand is Lebanon maintain its right to defend its natural resources.
For the Lebanese government, the point 29 will be considered as a negotiation point, and the 23 point will be considered as the realistic point that will draw the Lebanese borders over the sea.
The conflict over petrol and gas fields began more than 10 years ago when the U.S. proposed a so-called Hough Line, which is lower than Line 23, stripping Lebanon of some 860 square kilometers. President Michel Aoun, Prime Minister Mikati, and Speaker Nabih Berri all stressed a unified stance for Lebanon that the country will not concede its right to begin drilling offshore.
Because of the American embargo over on Lebanon, we can't drill for our rights to extract our gas and oil because we have to be delayed until the Israeli and Zionist entity to extract their wealth before us. Therefore, the American negotiator is taken aside, and it's very obvious that they are not negotiating for our benefit, but for the benefit of our enemy.
A recent move by Israel to attempt drilling in the Karish field, which falls within Line 29, has led to opposition from Beirut. Hezbollah Secretary General Said Hassan Nasrallah has also warned the floating petrol company Energean against drilling in that area, as long as it is disputed, and also cautioned that Israeli drilling could reach depths closer to potentially gas-rich Lebanese fields. Lebanon's main dilemma now is that time is running out and its natural resources could be looted at any time. Analysts believe the officials need to firstly demand that the U.S. lift its undeclared blockade and allow contracted companies to implement their obligations and drill in purely Lebanese fields. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
The battle for Donbass. Russia has air and artillery superiority. By some accounts, they are pounding Ukrainian positions with 50,000 shells a day. Particularly terrifying are their thermobaric missiles. They cause massive fireballs and suck out the oxygen from the surrounding air. The Ukrainians are well dug in places. These weapons can penetrate their trenches with devastating effect. The Guardian newspaper reports that between 600 and 1,000 Ukrainian soldiers are being killed or wounded every day. A horrific loss of human life and strategically unsustainable. The Russians too are thought to have had high casualties. It has been a long time since they have released their figures, but it is they who are moving forward slowly but surely. Peace talks broke down early on in the conflict. Both sides have had little interest in them since.
People have been dying here for years. We have thousands of infrastructure items destroyed. What about could we talk to Ukraine about now? And what Ukraine are we talking to? The one that is a terrorist state? There's no logic and no sense in negotiating with terrorists, for they'll be constantly changing their demands and trying to turn them in their favor. There have been negotiations from the beginning of Liberation Operation, and as you can see, it ends in nothing.
President Zelensky has made clear that he is not interested in talks unless Russia withdraws to the territory it held before February 24th. With Russia on the front foot on the battlefield, this will not happen.
We don't say this operation is against Ukraine, for it's actually NATO who are fighting against our republics now, the collective West. It's now some kind of front line of good and evil. That's why we might be ready to negotiate. The question is, what about? Ukraine has sold its people and its sovereignty to the West against the interest of its population. So these negotiations are with who and about what?
Now, just as Russia has massive political control over the Donetsk People's Republic and the Luhansk People's Republic, so does NATO have huge political control over Ukraine. It arms them, it funds them. And so when negotiations start and what terms will be on offer in negotiations, we're very much down to NATO's decisions rather than the Ukrainian government's.
The head of NATO, Jens Stoltenberg, recently said,
President Zelensky has stated many times this war will end at the negotiating table. The question is, what kind of position will the Ukrainians have when they negotiate a solution? Our responsibility is to make that position as strong as possible. We know that there is a very close link between what you can achieve at the negotiating table and your position on the battlefield. So our military support to them is a way to strengthen their hand.
Hundreds of soldiers, both Ukrainian and Russian, are being slaughtered every day in Donbass, so that their governments have a better hand at the negotiating table. Civilians on both sides are dying too. A mother and her 11-year-old child yesterday in Donetsk, killed by shelling of a market. Meanwhile, global leaders warn of a catastrophic global food crisis due to the conflict. Peace is still a long way off, and it looks set to be achieved on the battlefield. Johnny Miller, Donbass.
The community and wider supporters gathered to remember the victims of the Grenfell Inferno 5 years on. Many had gathered in the shadow of the building that still stands as a constant reminder of June 14th, when an inferno engulfed the tower block, leaving scores dead and thousands of others impacted and the nation traumatized. Dignitaries, including politicians and royalty, paid their respects, and for all the acts of heroism during the blaze and in its aftermath, the scars still run deep.
From my perspective, I feel like it's like a Muslim tragedy. in London because of the high number of Muslims that were living here, because it was during Ramadan, because of the impact that it's had on the local community. The very first person who was named was a Somalian Muslim out of the list of people who had died in Grenville. And I think the continuation of our story right now has to be on recognising the impact it had on the community here and what more can we do now.
The reoccurring theme when you speak with people here is the sense of frustration and anger at the way in which survivors, victims, the community, members of their family were all treated and continue to be treated. The pledges that were made, the promises that were broken, and the spectre of another Grenfell being possible.
The official Grenfell inquiry, chaired by Sir Martin Moore-Bick, that so far lasted 4 years and cost £149 million and counting, is attempting to figure out what truly happened and who was responsible. Those still fighting for answers are clear about what justice will mean in this case.
Justice will look like the fact that those people, the leaseholders, people in social housing, you know, in high-rise blocks, are living in habitable, affordable, safe homes. That is what justice will look like on one hand, and on the other hand, as I've said before, justice should look like those who are accountable for, who are responsible for this atrocity, are held accountable.
What I would like to ask this government is, what is it going to take for them to start taking this issue seriously? Is it because the people who died on Grenfell Tower on that night were mostly working class people, were mostly people of colour? Because we know that had Grenfell been in Canary Wharf, that building would not have been covered in illegal flammable cladding. It's utterly outstanding that we're 5 years on, we still have no answers. This community has received no justice, and still there are residents in this country that are living in buildings covered in the same illegal flammable cladding that was wrapped around Grenfell Tower.
Ahead of any official findings, the community of Grenfell march. They remember, and they will continue the fight for answers and justice. Amina Taylor, London.
Reading out the names of fallen British soldiers in Iraq while a man responsible for their deaths and millions more is honored. Only meters away, a protest organized by Stop the War Coalition calling for former Prime Minister Tony Blair's knighthood ceremony to stop.
It's an absolute outrage that someone who lied to the people, lied to Parliament, lied to the Cabinet, took us into an illegal war which led to the deaths of hundreds of thousands of people and destroyed a country should be given a knighthood. I mean, it's a disgrace.
The biggest of those lies in the so-called Iraq War dossier, a claim that former Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein possessed mass murder weapons.
We knew in September 2002 that the dossier amounted to nothing. We were told it proved there were weapons of mass destruction. Everybody serious who looked at that said it didn't prove anything of the sort. Blair was determined to go to war regardless. He was determined whatever the evidence said. So essentially they cooked up the evidence.
In 2016, all the lies were exposed by the so-called Chilcot report that concluded Iraq posed no immediate threat at the time of the 2003 invasion. For Tony Blair, though, who defended his decision to go to war, that has not meant a war crimes tribunal, but the UK's most prestigious knighthood. To anti-war activists, that is a dangerous precedent.
Well, it's trying to make it easier to go to war in future. It's trying to say to politicians, even if you go to war and it's illegal, it's criminal, it's based on lies, it has nothing but devastating impact, you can still be honoured, it'll be forgive and forget.
But forgive and forget they have not. Tony Blair continues to be one of the most detested politicians at home and abroad.
Nearly two decades since the Iraq War, Tony Blair is known by tens of millions here and abroad as a war criminal, despite efforts to reinvent himself as a visionary leader, which is why these protesters say the only court Tony Blair should be attending today is not a royal one. Saeed Burza, London.
As people in Afghanistan are facing acute hunger, poverty and deprivation, Kali Clements, the Deputy High Commissioner for UN Refugee Agency, and her delegation visited Kabul to address the humanitarian situation.
This is a very important moment for this country and the people of Afghanistan. It is a time where the world's attention has turned to other situations of displacement, other war, other conflicts, but the needs of the Afghan people are incredibly important, and it's one of the reasons why I have come here now to this country to see how we can best support the needs of the Afghan people.
The UNHCR commissioner also stressed the need for providing a safe ground in Afghanistan for Afghan refugees who want to return to their country and for the people to enjoy their rights.
In addition to the 3.5 million internally displaced people, women, children, and men, there are 6 million Afghans outside of Afghanistan that want to see a country at peace, that want to see a country that is stable, that is inclusive, and that looks after the needs of its people.
Meanwhile, the Taliban's acting minister for refugees affairs welcomed the delegation and said that Afghanistan is ready to cooperate with the UN bodies and other charities to assist the Afghan people.
We appreciate the UNHCR's work and programs in Afghanistan. We expect the international community and the UN to separate the humanitarian issues from political ones and continue their life-saving assistance to our country. We are fully ready to cooperate with them in all of their projects across the country.
In Afghanistan, war has subsided, but the impacts of drought, sanctions, and cuts in global aid continue to drive people from their homelands to other provinces and countries. The UN officials' visit to Afghanistan comes as the country faces widespread hunger and displacement. Afghans are calling for solidarity and funding from the international community. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
The day before France votes in their first round legislative elections, rallies were held around the country with two objectives. First, the far right is expected to win their greatest number of seats in 36 years, but that still only means less than 5% of the National Assembly. Second, the biggest question is, will President Emmanuel Macron retain his absolute majority and thus the ability to ram through more austerity-minded legislation? The left and Greens have surprisingly united, and the polls say Macron's coalition might get upset.
This government is not for the French people and for France, but is instead for the destruction of France. And look at the shameful police brutality at the recent Champions League final. That's what Yellow Vests have been enduring since November 17, 2018. And this government has just gotten worse and worse.
The Yellow Vests were a social revolt based around economic issues, and their list of demands are more relevant than ever. Lack of public services, low wages, high taxes, frozen pensions, and the increasing cost of the most essential goods are now major problems across the West. However, despite being the most popular social movement in recent French history, they aren't going to make major political inroads into parliament this election. Even if Macron's coalition doesn't win an outright absolute majority, their right-wing economic philosophy is certain to find support among the mainstream conservative party. They may dwindle to just 10% of seats, but that would be enough to keep parliament controlled by right-wing ideology. As first-round votes are often used for so-called protest votes, the results could be deceiving. The only certainty seems to be that Macronism has lost much of its appeal and momentum since 2017. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
On Sunday, some 9 million Italians were called to elect mayors and councillors in 971 towns and cities in a vote in which the strength of mainstream political parties has been put to the test before national elections next year. Elections were held in big cities such as Genoa, Verona and Palermo and in hundreds of provincial capitals. The turnout was lower than 50% in most municipalities, as disaffection with political actors and institutions continues to be on the rise. On Sunday, Italians were also called to vote on 5 referenda regarding justice issues. The referenda failed because they did not achieve the required quorum of 50% of voters, a further sign of electors' disenchantment with the country's politics.
The doors of the halls of power have been closed and the people got left out. I cast my ballot today simply to preserve my right to vote. The government should have not held a referendum on such technical justice matters. It's been just a waste of public resources.
Far-right party Brothers of Italy is likely to win the highest number of votes according to polls. The Brothers of Italy was the only party that stayed out of Mario Draghi's government. Nevertheless, the ideological distance between its leader, Giorgia Meloni, and Prime Minister Draghi is narrow. Meloni, a staunch NATO advocate, is supportive of Italy sending arms to Ukraine and of increased spending on defense.
Polling stations had been deserted by voters, not only because of disaffection with politics, but also because the Italian media barely talked about this referenda and local elections. Their focus is the war in Ukraine only. We are sick and tired of politicians' empty promises.
Since the start of the Ukraine conflict, opinion polls have steadily shown over half of the Italians oppose the sending of weapons to Ukraine and want the government to work for a peace proposal. Their calls have so far gone utterly unheard. Max Civili, Rome.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Limelight. In Georgia, United States Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger is fending off a challenger fueled by Donald Trump's election lies. But do American voters still care about the 2020 as much as the former president does? The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalist Maya King. The piece is titled, In Georgia, a GOP primary tests the power of a Trump vendetta. An anti-Trump Republican advocacy group recently organized a focus group of GOP voters in Georgia to get their take on perhaps the most competitive and consequential primary election in the state. They heard a lot of indecision. Most of the voters convened by the group The Republican Accountability Project knew little about the race between Brad Raffensperger, Georgia's Secretary of State, and his leading challenger, Representative Jody Heiss. Mr. Raffensperger seemed to get the benefit of the doubt until the voters were reminded of the backstory. As the state official responsible for certifying the 2020 presidential election results, Mr. Raffensperger rejected President Donald Trump's attempt to overturn his defeat. Trump then recruited Jody Heiss to seek revenge. "Go Jody, I guess," said one voter in Georgia. 3 out of 6 others agreed. The exchange offered a glimpse into why the Republican primary race for the office that oversees elections remains a dogfight just days from the election day on 24th of May. 2 years after Donald Trump lost Georgia by the slimmest of margins and Democrats captured both of the state's open Senate seats, wounds from the 2020 presidential election have still not completely healed for some partisans. But marshalling the residual anger to unseat an incumbent is not an easy feat. Brad Raffensperger has worked to win back Republicans by casting himself as a defender of election integrity, even as he has spent hours debunking a laundry list of false claims about the 2020 election. Some voters' memories and passions have faded. Many never had strong opinions about their Secretary of State. It all has made the race one of the purest tests yet of whether the 2020 election lie can be weaponized to win elections. While opinion polls have shown that leagues of Republican voters in Georgia and elsewhere largely embraced the fiction that the 2020 election was stolen in its immediate aftermath, it is not clear those concerns alone or Donald Trump's personal vendetta are enough to drive voters' choices. "I think 2020 was really a turning point in how closely people looked at things," said Sally Grubbs, chairwoman of the Cobb County Republican Party. Before, people might not have even realized that the Secretary of State was in charge of running the elections for the state, but now they're keenly aware of it. Jody Heiss, whom Donald Trump endorsed last year, is one of more than a dozen candidates running for Secretary of State under the America First banner, alongside others in battleground states like Arizona, Michigan, and Ohio. They share an unflinching loyalty to Donald Trump and a belief that the 2020 election was marred. Some are calling for a law enforcement arm to more aggressively prosecute violators of election laws. Opinion polls show large numbers of undecided voters in the race, with Mr. Heiss and Mr. Raffensperger neck and neck, each with about one-third of the vote. Both campaigns are braced for a runoff. Donald Trump's attempt at payback for 2020 in Georgia is floundering in the state's other marquee primary on Tuesday. Former Senator David Perdue, his pick to challenge Governor Brian Kemp after the governor refused to overturn the election results, is trailing Mr. Kemp in opinion polls and fundraising. Donald Trump has hardly weighed in publicly on David Perdue's prospects since hosting a tele-rally for the former senator in April. His former vice president, Mike Pence, is set to visit the state to campaign for Governor Brian Kemp on the eve of the primary election. Mr. Kemp has been adept at using his office to win over skeptical Republicans, passing a slew of conservative policies on elections, law enforcement, and education. For voters still enthralled with false claims of fraud, Governor Brian Kemp can point to the Election Integrity Act of 2021, which limits provisions like ballot drop boxes and mobile voting centers. When voters see that kind of activity around, the concerns they have, It just becomes difficult to drive an argument that people who are in office are being inattentive to the issue, said Brad Alexander, an Atlanta, Georgia-based political consultant and Raffensperger supporter, who was among several who argued that the potency of the stolen election debate has started to wane. In January, 43% of Georgia Republican voters said they were confident that the November elections would be fair and accurate, according to a University of Georgia opinion poll. By April, that number had increased to nearly 60%, and a record number of voters have already participated in the state's primary elections, topping more than 700,000 voters on the final day of early voting. Jody Heiss, a four-term congressman, was one of the 147 House Republicans who voted against certifying the election results for President Joe Biden. He later took part in a White House meeting alongside Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene to try to determine how the election results could be flipped in Donald Trump's favor. He has claimed falsely that Mr. Trump would have won in Georgia if the election had been fair. At a meeting with the Atlanta Young Republicans on Thursday, 19th of May, Jody Heiss made unsupported claims about ballot harvesting, said he no longer wanted to use Dominion voting machines, and slammed Mr. Raffensperger for sending out unsolicited absentee ballots ahead of the last election. The voice of the people had been violated in 2020, he said. County officials in Georgia identified 64 cases of potential fraud out of the state's roughly 5 million votes in the 2020 election, according to an Associated Press survey of all but 11 of the state's 159 counties. But Mr. Heiss has tried to make his case about more than just 2020, raising the prospect of fraud in the future. This issue is not who wins an election, but the issue is absolutely, was it a fair election, he said. If the election itself is compromised or violated, then all the effort out there really doesn't matter anymore. And that's what we've got to defend. That's what we've got to protect at all costs. Most of the young Republicans in the room said they wanted to hear what Jody Heiss would do differently from Brad Raffensperger in elections, should he be elected. Even if you're not a dogmatic election was stolen person, there are a lot of people with reasonable doubt. And that reasonable suspicion is fair, said Chris Campbell, a 39-year-old national accounts manager at SmartFeeds. Raffensperger didn't address those concerns well, and people don't have confidence in him. But I do have confidence in Jody Heiss and trust that he would run the office with integrity. But there were clear divisions over that conclusion. Questions around the 2020 election, like was it stolen or was it not stolen, aren't healthy, said Alan English, the president of the Atlanta Young Republicans, who remained undecided between the candidates. Looking back at 2020 isn't productive, he said. Many Republicans declared Mr. Raffensperger all but defeated as soon as he announced he would run for re-election, citing Donald Trump's ire and that of many voters. Mr. Raffensperger was censured at a state GOP convention last year, but Donald Trump has been unexpectedly quiet about the race beyond lumping Mr. Raffensperger in with Mr. Kemp in statements railing against what he calls the rhinos, or Republicans in name only, running the state. Sarah Longwell, the founder of the Republican Accountability Project, which conducted the focus group last week, said that Donald Trump's limited involvement could be playing a role in some voters' indecision. Mr. Raffensperger has raised more money than his competitors, courting far-right voters and touting what he calls true conservative values. At an event hosted by the Buckhead Young Republicans, Mr. Raffensperger discussed the 2020 election, but said his office was focused on the real issue of preventing non-citizens from voting. Mr. Raffensperger has called for amending the state constitution to prohibit non-citizens from voting, something that state law already forbids. A state review found no instances of ballots being cast by non-citizens in 2020. Mr. Raffensperger acknowledges that his pitch has done little to pacify some Republicans. "I was never public enemy number one. I just think that some people weren't pleased with the election results," he said. "But in this race here, I'm leaving it to the goodness of my fellow Georgians who stood for the law, made sure that we followed the Constitution and followed the law. And that's all I can do." The roughly 15 people present at the event, mostly 20-something conservatives, were receptive of his message. While some still had concerns about election oversight, they said they appreciated his candor in the face of ongoing attacks. "There wasn't anything that anyone else would have done to do anything," said Bradley Schober, a 27-year-old, an attorney who said he had already voted for Mr. Raffensperger. Ultimately, the guy took as much heat as anybody and came out on the other side standing. Despite the high interest in the showdown, less than $1 million has been spent on television advertising in both the Democratic and Republican primary races for Georgia's Secretary of State, according to Ad Impact, an ad advertisement tracking firm which the candidates exchanging attacks over the outcome of the 2020 presidential election and voting integrity. Jody Heiser's adverts have showcased footage of him and Donald Trump at a rally in Georgia, where the former president called Mr. Raffensperger a rhino and one of the worst Secretary of States in America. Mr. Raffensperger's advertisements have tried to rally Republicans against their common opponent, Stacey Abrams, the Democratic nominee for governor. The group she founded, Fair Fight, sued the state over discriminatory election practices in 2018. The lawsuit is currently in court. When Stacey Abrams attacked Georgia's elections, Jody Heiss did nothing, the advertisement's narrator says. The biggest spender on broadcast television has been B. Nguyen, the leading candidate in the Democratic primary, who has cast herself as a bulwark against Republican efforts to restrict voting access and meddle in the elections. "When our voting rights are attacked," Ms. Nguyen says in one advertisement, "we all lose."
Seven, very much pressure.
We come to you, and O God, knowing that thou art our only King.
You're listening to the program Bookshelf on IRIB English Radio with Brother Yasser Ibrahim.
A'udhu billahi min ash-shaytan ar-rajim. Bismillahi ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Alhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad wa ajjil farajahum. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, dear listeners. Welcome to another episode of Bookshelf on IRIB English Radio with me, Brother Yasser Ibrahim. Islam as a religion has a particular foundation, has principles, and it is those principles that make Islam such a beautiful, such a pristine, such an inviting religion. It is religion, as we all know, is the fastest growing religion. Unfortunately, because of the efforts of the enemies, the speed of growth has slowed down, but it does not mean that it's still not growing. There are people all across the world who somehow, by the grace of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, are becoming aware of this pristine and pure message and coming into the fold of Islam. So the book that we would like to introduce to our dear listeners today is a book that tries to clarify and to make clear what Islam actually is and the primary sources of Islamic thought. What do they say? That the Holy Quran and Ahadith of the Holy Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa sallam and the infallible and immaculate Imams from his progeny, what do they say? Not what other people have said about Islam. What does Islam say about particular issues? You know, what is the core and the fundamentals and the principles that Islam aims to show to a particular individual and towards its followers? So inshallah, this is the book that we would like to introduce to our dear listeners is on this particular topic. So please stay tuned.
Why do we read books in the first place? What are books good for?
We read books because we don't want to reinvent the wheel, if you will.
We'd better take advantage of human cultural and intellectual heritage, particularly related to our daily activities, such as our physical, mental, spiritual, or even religious health.
We can't ignore the past thoughts and experiences. To do so, we need to boost our bookshelf.
Welcome back, dear listeners, to our program Bookshelf on IRIB English Radio with me, Brother Yasser Ibrahim. So the book that we would like to introduce to our dear listeners is titled The Core of Islam. So this work, The Core of Islam, again, was recorded and edited by Brother Ammar Hegedus. My apologies if I pronounce it incorrectly. So it is, he mentions in the editor's note that this singular introduction to Islam in the English language presents in one easily accessible volume a coherent overview of the structures and practices of the faith of Islam. Informed by a profound level of Islamic scholarship, it answers many commonly asked questions of this much maligned faith. It is the fruit of incessant questions, why, that the almost unbelievably patient, kind, generous, and knowledgeable Ayatollah Milani was prepared to give of his time to answer. So we can see this was based on a session of questions and answers to the Sayyid, which were then recorded, edited, and put in a book form. A quest to acquire knowledge of the faith, like any journey of discovery, is fraught with sometimes seemingly unsurpassable difficulty. Those who have not studied Islam and Islamic history in some depth find many mundane and profound issues difficult to access. For example, what was the cultural context in which Islam developed? What are the faith's core beliefs? What is sacred to Muslims? What social behavior does Islam teach? What is the position of women in Islam? What are its main groupings? And most importantly, how can one best worship Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala? Allah willing, this according to the editor, later volumes will provide greater detail on both scholarly and spiritual aspects of the faith. So this is basically what this book is entailed. And hopefully, inshallah, in our next segment, we'll be reading a portion from the book for the benefit of our dear listeners. So please stay tuned.
Among the sacred texts we have received to help us understand where we came from and where we are going as a human race are most rich in helping us find our direction. They narrate stories of our past. But where have they brought us? Where are their messages now? Are we the people of belief, or have we become the people of the boxes? Is there wisdom trapped in our bookshelves? Bookshelves, bookshelves, bookshelves.
Welcome back, dear listeners, to our program Bookshelf on IRIB English Radio. The book that we have introduced to our dear listeners is titled The Core of Islam by Ayatollah Sayyid Fadhil Husseini Milani, recorded and edited by Brother Ammar Hegedus. So one of these sections is titled Principles of Faith. It is within the section of the main groupings of Islam. And on page 85 of this book. So the Sayyid obviously was asked this question about what are the main groupings of Islam, maybe. And this is his answer. So it says principles of faith. From the earliest days of Islam, scholars debated a variety of issues that today form the basis of what we refer to as Islamic theology. Namely, are divine attributes part of the essence or separate from it? Is the Holy Quran eternal or created? Do people have free will or are all things preordained? Is a sinner to be regarded as an unbeliever? Plus a variety of other equally arcane subjects. The first disagreement that was made public arose between the Asharites and the Mu'tazilites. Now, these are both groupings of the Islamic theology, which came about in the second century of Hijri, who had established their own Sunni school of theology, which is known as Kalam. While the former group were known for uncompromising adherence to tradition, that is the Asharites, the latter were known as defenders of the intellect. Throughout history, various caliphs adopted contradictory stances. That, e.g., for example, the Abbasid Caliph Al-Mu'min, 1198 to 218 AH, when he lived and died, supported Mu'tazila doctrine, while the Caliph Al-Mutawakkil, from 232 to 247 AH, sorry, that's not the date that they died, that is the date of the Khilafah, endorsed and supported the Asharite doctrine. Qadi Abu Bakr Baqilani, who died in the year 403 AH, the most influential scholar of his time to spread Asharite doctrine, spared no effort in his attempt to establish this belief as the sole presentation of Sunni faith. He resolutely attacked the Mu'tazilites to the extent that few were emboldened to adopt that madhab. And anyway, he goes on and he explains the history of the theology and the debates between the Asharites and the Mu'tazilites. So this is one of the few and topics that is discussed in this book. It deals with Kalam, it deals with sociology, it deals with jurisprudence, it deals with all sorts of acts of worship and so on and so forth that are the core, that are the principles, that are the foundations of the Islamic faith. We ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to enable us to firstly understand these foundations, these fundamentals, these core, and then also to practice upon it, and then obviously, hopefully, inshallah, to show others that this religion that we follow is not something that what is shown in the media, but rather it has a pure, pristine, and an immaculate foundation. Inshallah, until next time, my dear brothers and sisters, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was the program Bookshelf with Brother Yasser Ibrahim on RIB English Radio.
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.